Okay, so the last 2 weeks we've been doing the Agadot of what? Suffering, theodicy, justice, and the like. Now, like I said, if I wanted to, I could have started the year with this Agadata and then spoke about it for the entire year, right? I could have done that.
Yeah.
I didn't. and I just don't know how many weeks I want to go on.
You don't want to with this.
I mean, look, I understand that we're in the middle of, you know, that the world has suddenly gone into chaos. I understand that maybe the right thing to do is spend the rest of the year doing suffering. But I'm just not. What? Oh, ho, ho. Yeah. So I really don't know. But I think what I'm going to try to do is take my cue from right, Dr. Aaron Siegel, who gave a four-part series on this last year, and then at least lay out certain approaches, both in secular philosophy and Jewish philosophy, to suffering, as, you know, just sort of lay out some of the positions. And you tell me how many weeks you want to go on with this. Right. At some point, I think there are other, you know, because it's brachot. If this was like, you know, I don't know, Menachot, it was like each week I was like, okay, there aren't that many Agadotas, so I can squeeze out whatever I want of each Agadota that there is. In Brachot, every week I spend on the same Agadota is another 50, you know, Agadot I never touch. Now, of course, I can do that so that I can delay ever having to speak about dreams, you know, which is obviously what I never want to do. Hey, you already got me to do demons, okay, right? No, maybe I'll do dreams. Though Kobe wanted to do dreams, right, Kobe? Kobe wanted to teach dreams. That's right. Mordechai has volunteered. Yes. 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 Okay. Fine. So, okay. Okay. yes. Okay, fine. So what I'm going to do is I'm really going to take my cue here from Aaron Siegel. You know, he categorized it very nicely. And hopefully, at least I'll give you a taste of it. You can listen to his full series if you want it. So again, if you remember, the first week we talked about the unique problem of theodicy in Jewish philosophy, where fundamentally, while in, let's say, Christian philosophy and secular philosophy, it's the problem of evil, because they, especially Christian philosophy, spends a lot of time on the idea that God is, you know, the four O's, right? Omni, this, that, and the other thing, right? Omniscient. Right, right, omnipresent, but omnibenevolent. He's all good, so obviously evil was a problem. I didn't give that anything. You know, and therefore, like, Christian thinkers spend a lot of time not just dealing with this, but specifically dealing with the question of whether the existence of evil disproves God. Right. So, for example, Alvin Plantinga. In Knowledge and Christian Belief, devotes space to this. He devotes almost an entire book to this, right? If you want a short version. You know how Alvin Plantinga goes?
No.
Oh, sorry. What's his name? Alvin Plantinga is a Christian analytic philosopher in Notre Dame.
No.
Zach mentioned him in his Chabura. So, right. So he deals a lot with this in, as I said, in a shortened version in Wisdom and Christian Belief, Knowledge and Christian Belief. And in a fuller version in, what's the title of it? God, Freedom and Evil. God, Freedom and Evil. Where the full book is basically devoted to this topic. That was an early version of this in 1974, republished in 77, again 2002, right? So Plantinga has really written a lot about this. And in general, Christian thinkers think about this a lot. But Jews less. We talked about that 2 weeks ago, that Jewish thinkers tend to be more animated by the problem of justice, right, of good things happening to bad people, bad things happening to good people, than simply the existence of bad, existence of evil. And even within that, there's some who argue that it's really bad things happening to good people and not the other way around. It's not just justice. We're willing to sort of live with the fact that God might be kind, kind undeservedly, but that he should be unkind undeservedly we have problems with, despite the fact that, you know, Eov sounds like that. I don't know. When we finish Iyov, Mordechai, you'll give a chabur on it, and you will survey all the Rishonim and all their books on it. You know, in your free time, you'll just read all the books by the Rishonim just on Iyov.
Sure.
Yes. Fun times. Correct. And then what we did last week was we pointed out two main things, right? One was that even though certain Rishonim, like the Ramban, tend to really try to find the justice here, erring more on the side of that position, the Gemara and Dav Zayin, that Moshe did learn the secrets of theodicy. They therefore, for example, by Yisurin Shel Ava, which we touched on briefly, where Rashi is comfortable saying that sometimes you're punished, and you simply get more reward, and that's okay. The Rambam and the Ramban are not comfortable with that, and they look for sins that are like lesser sins or something like that to attribute it to that. You know, if you want, right, there, you know, I could spend hours just talking about what I think Rabbi Yosef Albo's unique perspective on Yisrael and Shalava is, but like I said, there's a limit to what I mean, can do. If you want me to do it, I can. That was my first term paper. NYU was on that topic because my first semester in NYU, I took a class called Suffering and Evil or Meaning of Suffering, or it went through different names, whatever, with Rai Karmi. And my final paper was on Rabbi Yosef Albo's idea of suffering and specifically Yisurin Shel Ava. I think he has a unique perspective on it. So that was one thing, was that despite the fact the Rambam and the like think that way, there's a lot of evidence in that that's not the only voice in Chazal. And therefore, Chazal talk about the possibility of you suffering because the mashchit has been given power, right? It's a time of plague, collective suffering, and things like that. I mean, the second thing we pointed out from Jeffrey Rubenstein was that the thrust of the Gemara and Daf Hey is that theology is insufficient in most people's lives, right? And as Mordechai knows, as you go through Iyov, right, you just read it and like, look, maybe you're right philosophically, but really, your friend just lost all his kids. All his wealth, and he's covered in boils, and all you can do is say, well, it's all fair, right? And what he says is, right, as we read today, listen, I don't care. You think God is happy with you? You're giving these false defenses? He's not. I am happy to speak my mind to God. If God would give me the time, I would yell at him, tell him it's unfair, right? But don't try to defend him. Right? What? Yes, he's like, what else is he going to do to me? Right. You know, this is how I feel with, you know, Lahavdil with Putin. What more can he threaten? And then he comes out, if you do anything, I will bring nuclear holocaust. Oh, really? Well, that escalated fast. So there's always something else you can do. but okay. So what are the responses? If we want to try to make sense of it, so what do we do? Now, I will note that in the you really need to ask multiple questions about this, about theodicy. One is, what do we want out of theodicy, right? One possibility is we want truth, right? We want truth. Like, we study theodicy because we want to understand God's ways. The second is we study theodicy, we study theories of divine justice, because for experiential reasons, for existential reasons, it helps us get through the hard times, right? Yeah, the Nafkamina, right? And this is spelled out quite carefully in David Chatz's article in the new book that Ginsburg brought on Judaism in an Analytic Age. You know, part of it is, I mean, I noted this already in Tosfot. When we're looking at a theodicy, are we trying to explain definitively how God runs the world? Or are we trying to suggest a plausible explanation? Meaning, do we really care if we got it right, so to speak? If the reason we seek theodicy is because we want to understand God, then it's important that we get it right. If we study theodicy because we need a plausible explanation to help ourselves get through the tough times, then it matters less that we have the right one, or if that's too harsh, it matters less that we have a complete one, right? It matters less if we have a complete one, right? Because it could be, listen, I don't understand everything, but I have certain ideas that begin to help me understand this. And maybe I don't understand everything, and maybe I can't apply it in every situation, and maybe I'm misapplying it here, right? But if it's less about understanding God and more about being able to live with God, then that matters less, right? It matters less. So we need to ask ourselves. Correct. Right, exactly. We approach it differently. And similarly, people who oppose theodicy, right, the study, trying to understand it, could oppose it either on the grounds that it's you're not going to be able to figure it out, right, and therefore it's false, or could they could oppose it on pragmatic grounds, which is it's not going to be helpful, right? And therefore, as we'll see, there are many thinkers who will say, listen, we just, not that it's necessarily wrong, but we prefer non-explanatory approaches to suffering. And we already noted this when we first read the Gemara, right? That in many ways, this whole question, right, this big philosophical question of what are we trying to do in theodicy, comes down to that first line in the Gemara, right? Remember, what was the first line in the Gemara Daf Hey? If you suffer, start doing tshuva, right? And figure out the sin. Now, why is that, right? Is that because it's presuming a certain theodicy, a certain idea that every time you suffer, there's a one-to-one correspondence, ideally, and therefore it's telling you this is you do this because this is caused by justice, or is it telling you it might be, and therefore the proper religious response to suffering is to act as if this is a function of what you did and not to squander the opportunity? That doesn't mean we're definitively claiming that that's why it's happening, right? You could read that line in the Gemara both ways. Okay, yeah. What? Yes, you can. That would be exactly what it might mean. I mean, that's exactly what it might mean. Now, you might say that it's not plausible, and therefore you might say, I don't want to, right? Right, no, in Echanami, there's a lot of opposition to it. Now, you're right. Okay, I didn't want to get into this too much, but yes, there are the moral critiques of theodicy, right? There are the people who say, don't come up with theodicy because then it, right, certain people claim, and again, Dr. Schatz goes through this and then responds to it. He says, some people claim, listen, you shouldn't study theodicy because it makes you callous, right? Because if you, right, as you see in Eov, right, the more you obsess about everything is just, so instead of saying, we're really sorry, Eov, what's happening, they say, you deserved losing all your kids because otherwise God wouldn't do it, right? So yeah, there is a certain callousness that might come with it. But as Professor Schatz notes, lav dafka, right? Meaning it could be that it's more, as we talked about, a question of timing, right? Meaning it could be that the proper response in the moment is not to say, well, what did you do wrong? You know, I know you just lost your child. What did you do wrong? Right? But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be armed, so to speak, with thoughts about this, right? There are a lot of things that in the moment, they're not the proper response. That doesn't mean that there isn't room to prepare yourself religiously by thinking about it in that way. Okay, so with that, so there are many types of theories, but Aaron Siegel divides it into what he calls, I'll tell you his three titles, okay? I do think it's nicely organized. He's always brilliant. I've known him since I was very young. When I was your age, actually. When I was in Shan Aleph, he gave the Iyun Chabura Thursday nights in Gush, which is when I got to know him. And since then, he, you know, was a Talmud Muvak of Lichtenstein and then got a PhD in metaphysics at Notre Dame and is a professor of metaphysics at Hebrew U. He's a very, very
one smart guy.
Very, very, very sweet, very smart. So he divides them, sort of broadly speaking, into three categories, okay? One are theodicies of Gadlut HaAdam, right? Theodicies that justify themselves from the vantage point of the greatness of man. Okay, we'll see what that means in a minute. Theodicies of Katnut HaAdam, right? Theodicies that focus on the insignificance of man, right? And then he talks about skeptical theism and anti-theodicy, okay? So I'm going to really try to run through this today, at least touch on each of them. And then, you know, if you decide that there's something you really want to spend forever on and we should keep doing suffering for months, then we can do that. But
I mean, God is just like,
oh, okay, so, great, so punished, so not quite that. So this in non-Jewish thought, this is often called soul-making theodicy. Okay. So John Hick, in a very well-known book, Evil and the God of Love, argues as follows, that I suggest then that is an ethically reasonable judgment, even though in the nature of the case, not one that is capable of demonstrative proof, that human goodness slowly built up through personal histories and moral effort has a value in the eyes of the Creator, which justifies even the long travail of the soul-making process. Right? Meaning, if you think that people grow from struggle, and the point of human beings in this world is to grow, then you must give them struggles, right? The picture with which we are working is thus developmental and teleological. Man is in the process of becoming the perfected being whom God is seeking to create. Exactly. And that's always the problem. Right. But it is true. Right. There's, Nicholas Nassim Taleb has written about this extensively. He coined really the idea of anti-fragility. And then this was developed further by Jonathan Haidt and George Lukianoff, I think, is in The Coddling of the American Mind. This idea that. People grow, right? It's not, right? Anti-fragility. What is anti-fragility?
Not fragile.
No, that's exactly what it is. It's anti-fragile. He says, what's anti-fragility? So he says, for example, think about immunity, right? Think about immunity, right? It's that by giving someone a vaccine, right? You weaken them temporarily, and by fighting, learning how to fight, right? Their body becomes immune, right? That's not fragile. It's anti-fragile. It's exactly. You only become strong by being challenged, right? So, right. His classic example is a vaccine, right? Or is immunity to disease, right? Correct. Right. Working out is the same way, right? Where the way your muscles grow is by, right, working them past capacity, right? So this is basically the idea of. Right, so he says, if there's any true analogy between God's purpose for his human creatures and the purpose of loving and wise parents for their children, we have to recognize the presence of pleasure and the absence of pain cannot be the supreme and overriding end for which the world exists. Rather, this world must be a place of soul making, and its value is to be judged not primarily by the quantity of pleasure and pain occurring at any particular moment, by its fitness for its primary purpose, the purpose of soul making. Right?
So that it's like. Every single Easterian is just Easterian.
This is John Hick. He's a Christian philosopher.
Oh, okay, yeah.
No. So, but I say in sort of the general world, John Hick has made this his theory. Now, soul making theodicy is not actually a big huge deal in Jewish thought. It does make it. I'm not saying it doesn't. I tend to actually think that much of the discussion about Nisayon sometimes goes on this, but. So what Aaron Siegel pointed out is that at some point, Jewish thought has half of this, meaning
John Hick makes two claims. One is that the purpose of the world is not pleasure, but soul making. And the second is suffering may be necessary for soul making and therefore is justified because it contributes to that. There's no denying that Jewish thought buys half of that equation. Which is that the purpose of the world, at least one of the purposes of the world, is soul making, right? Is that people can grow spiritually and ethically, and right? I don't know if I need to prove that to you, right? But you can go through a lot of Jewish thought that buys that, right? And you know, the Ramban says that he kavanada yitzirah ein lanu tam acher b'yitzirah rishona. This is the purpose of creation. But a lot of midrashim, right? The midrashim, for example, I'll just run through them. I'm not going to read them inside, but for example. The Machloket Rabbi Akiva and Tarnas Rufus. When Tarnas Rufus says, why would God create the world imperfect and make you have a Brit Mila? Why didn't he make you born? Right? Why aren't people born without it? So he says, what do you mean? Right? In order to, because God gave us the mitzvah to purify us. Right? He said, because God gave us the mitzvah to purify us. So there's no denying that, or as we talked about already in Daf Yud, right, we spent a lot of time on the. Actually, we didn't do this. We did the beginning of this, right? In the Reb Meir Buria ones, right? So in the continuation, in what this is Bracha on Daf Yud,
right? So you have the continuation. There were you have another machloket, Turnus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva, where Turnus Rufus says, Rabbi Akiva, aren't you going to hell because you give tzedakah, right? And if God made people poor, who are you to give them money? And he said, no, right? God wants us to support them. Now that Gemara already, it clearly focuses on soul making, but it does already touch on the possibility of a soul making theodicy, right? Because assuming that poverty is one of those ills that needs to be justified, the fact that you can in any way justify poverty because God will save us from Gehenna because we give tzedakah, right? So you definitely could look at the Gemara and see not just that the purpose of the world is for people to improve themselves, but that at some level that might even justify a certain measure of suffering.
Poverty is the best because they get to build themselves through being poor and we get to build ourselves through
Yeah, maybe, right? Now, you know, from... but what Aaron Siegel points out is potentially, this is what Rashi means in Yisurin Shalafa. It's possible, right? That when Rashi says, what is Yisurin Shalafa? That God, he causes you to suffer in this world, to reward you more in the next world, more than your merit. So you could just read it that Rashi really thinks that God slaps you across the face, right? God says, if you let me slap you across the face, I'll give you $5, right? And he keeps slapping you, right? You could read Rashi that way. Or you could say that that's not what he means. He means that he makes you suffer, you don't deserve it, so that you grow into the type of person that deserves more reward. Now, I'm not sure Rashi means that, but I do think that there are Rishonim, and I'm not going to go through and prove it, but there are definitely Rishonim who understand that as being the meaning of Nisayon, right? That God makes you actually go through the process of being tested.
Yeah, that would fit in really well with Avram's theme of, like, being tested 10 times, and therefore he becomes the Av.
Yeah, right. No, that's exactly what it is, right? And definitely some of it, and the Rambam does in certain places sound like this, or, right, again, is this his full theodicy? No. Does he have lines like this? Yes. So in the context of Nisayon, he says, people have generally the notion that trial consists in afflictions and mishaps sent by God to man, not as punishments for past sins, but as given opportunity for great reward. He rejects that, right? He doesn't like this at all. Right, because he assumes perfect justice, but the one who really does at some level think this, and again, this part is part of my broader claim in the Sefer Yikarim, and if you want, I can send you my paper that I wrote many, many, many years ago. Not so long, it was probably 15, 20 pages. I was very proud of it, because I wasn't like, I was rusty on writing essays when I got back to YU. Yeah, I mean, look, I was very proud because it was my first major paper when I got back to college, and it won the award that year for the best paper in Jewish studies in the university, which I was very touched. I don't know if I really deserve that, but I don't know if Ray Carvey really liked it. I mean, I wrote it when I was 20, right? Yeah. It was my first year in YU, right? It wasn't like,
you know.
No, I didn't. But I do think that in Rabbi Yosef Albo, there are passages like this, and I'm glad that he agrees with me in this sense. So he writes, I'll read you the English translation, that sometimes the Holy One, blessed be He, brings affliction upon the righteous in order to test him, to see if he's serving Hashem with true love, as it says, for the Lord your God putteth you to proof, to know whether, etc., if he's serving from the love of reward of punishment. And so when the Holy One, blessed be He, brings affliction on the righteous, they're called afflictions of love, since through them it becomes manifest that people who save the righteous who prosper, they are not serving from love. Right now in this one, he says it more shows other people. Right, but there are other places where he talks about the fact that it actually changes the way you're actually committed to God. He says that a little bit later in that same perek where he says, what is real Yisurin Shel Ava for him? Right, again, so this really ties it back to our Gemara. Right, the suffering that comes to give you more schar, but not like Rashi, which the simple shot is, I slap you across the face, you get $5, is Shir lo schar mazetov, lo schar machshava tov bilvad. That God will give you the reward of having performed a good action and not just having good intentions. Right? That there's a different level to instantiating your intentions, right? In action, and not just, being the type of person who could, in theory,
survive that, right? So there are these people who believe that that's what, yeah. And, you know, in some ways, then Tzivir Olam, right, says something like this, right? Also in Yisurin Shalava, Ki kasher adam hu tzadik v'ra'uy el ma'alel el yonah, when someone is a tzadik and is worthy of these high levels, v'adam mitzad aguf yesh bo tzad ma'she'ena ra'uy el oto ma'ala, but there's something in him that isn't, right? There's an imperfection. She'ena adam ra'uy el oto ma'ala mitzad echisron she'adavek b'chomer, right? He's too attached to physicality. HaKadosh Baruch Hu mevi alav Yisurin k'dei l'mareka nefesh. God sometimes brings suffering to cleanse your soul, she'adavek b'chomer, that's too attached to physicality, to bring you to a higher level, because your soul won't deserve it as long as it has that flaw. So even though he's sort of talking punishment language, he's framing it, if we use sort of modern terminology, he's talking punishment, but he's talking rehabilitative rather than retributive punishment. Right? Meaning the justification for punishment is not retribution. It's not that God wants to punish you, but he wants to rehabilitate you. Right? So even within punishment, if you look at punishment as a means to rehabilitate rather than be retributive, right, to punish per se, then you can look at that as some sort of soul-making, right, theodicy, even within a punishment-based based theodicy. The Rav, in certain passages, does describe this. So in Out of the Whirlwind, which is, his discovering of suffering in Eov, he does talk a little bit just emotionally about how this affects it. So he says, the same is true of the man of sorrow. When the blow strikes, the first question which pops up upon the lips of the sufferer is, why me? Why should I be different from others? Why was I selected to explore the value of sorrow? A feeling of envy fills out the heart of the afflicted. He envies everybody, pauper and prince, young and old. They were spared while I was picked out. When I eulogized my uncle, Rebelvel Soloveitchik Zatzal, in the auditorium of his university, while knowing of my affliction, one nagging thought assailed my mind. All these thousands of people are healthy and expect to live a long and happy life, whereas I am not certain that I will be able to accompany my daughter to the wedding canopy. While these thoughts are passing through one's mind with the speed of lightning, one feels forsaken, forlorn, and lonely. I am different. I have met with a strange destiny. No one else is like me. Gradually, this feeling of loneliness pervades one's whole being with ever-increasing predominance. The whole self becomes immersed in solitude and the awareness of being taken away from the community. The man who is bound to others by countless invisible threads is torn loose from his social bearings. He makes his exit from the community and retreats from himself because he was singled out. Elisha, upon being elected, abandoned his father and mother. The elected retreats even from his closest friends and beloved ones, not excluding wife and children. That night before my operation, when my family said goodbye to me, I understood the words of the psalmist, Ki aviv imi azavuni v'ashem ya'asveini. When my mother and my father forsake me, the Lord will take me up. I never understood this verse. Did ever a parent abandon his child? Of course not. Yet in certain situations, one is cut off even from his parents or his beloved wife and children. Community life, togetherness is always imbued with the spirit of cooperation, of mutual help and protection. Suddenly, one realizes that there is no help which his loved ones are able to extend him. They are onlookers who watch a drama unfolding itself with an unalterable speed. They are not involved in it. This realization brings to an abrupt end the feeling of togetherness. I stand before God. No one else is beside me. A lonely being meeting the loneliest being in utter seclusion is a traumatic but also a great experience. That these two experiences, that of non-being and that of loneliness, must not be forgotten. Right? So,
that's some good writing.
Yes. So experientially, right, people do talk about this, right, that suffering brings you to a level you couldn't have reached. Does that justify it? Maybe, maybe not, right? But there are definitely thinkers who experientially or theologically do talk about some sort of soul-making theology. Correct. Right. Yeah. And I do think, by the way, I do think there's a lot of this in Joseph Albo, which again, I'm not going to prove that now. Okay.
Why would God create a system where the way to get closer to the oneness of God is through suffering?
Right, so that's the problem, right? And that is what Aaron Siegel called the inherent tension in theodicies of greatness, right? Which is
that if you look through the Midrashim, right, you know, consistently, like, we try to stop it, right? Like, Moshe tries to stop suffering, right? Stop God from just, right, hurting the Jewish people, right? If this was enough, that every time you suffer, you could grow, right? Obviously, we wouldn't, right? There's a tension, right, inherent in it. And of course, right, you know, you have to talk about, yeah, and then you have to ask the question, like, why would God create a world where the only way for us to grow is through suffering, right? Right. So there is a tension here, and it might not, therefore, be sufficient. Now, a corollary of this is free will theodicy, right? Which is not the belief that suffering per se is necessary, but rather free will is necessary, and free will creates the impossibility of God preventing suffering, because the only way to do that, at least human inflicted suffering, is to take away free will, right? So that's sort of a corollary to this, which is saying not that God directly makes you suffer for your greatness, but that God won't stop you from causing suffering because of the importance of free will.
Can't control that within your free will.
Right. So let's just see like a few examples of this, and then we'll talk about the problems with this as well. So for example, Eliezer Berkowitz says in Faith After the Holocaust, man can be frightened, but he cannot be bludgeoned into goodness. If God did not respect man's freedom to choose his course and personal responsibility, not only would the moral good and evil be abolished from the earth, but man himself would go with them. For freedom and responsibility are of the very essence of man. Without them, man is not human. If there is to be man, he must be allowed to make his choices in freedom. If he has such freedom, he will use it. Using it, he will often use it wrongly. He will decide for the wrong alternative. As he does so, there will be suffering for the innocent. Right? So there is this idea. Now, obviously, this is complicated from the fact that, by the fact that, yes, you have to ask the questions. Again, I won't go through everything, but at some level, the balance to this is, well, okay, but really, does God need you to be able to successfully, right, torture that person, right? He can't make it that, you know, whatever, I don't know, right? The someone who deserves it will be the brunt of it, right? You know, plus the obvious problem, which is that not all suffering is caused by human beings, right? So, right, free will theodicy only explains a certain amount of suffering, that which is caused by human beings. Okay, but this is category one, which is those that focus on the greatness of man, either saying that suffering itself causes you to be great, which again, we definitely believe that the purpose of the world is for people to grow. That means that there are hints here and there of the possibility that sometimes suffering might be justified because it makes you closer to God, it perfects your soul, and the like. But that doesn't seem to be the only theodicy definitely working in Judaism. There is a fair bit of free will theodicy, which is a related idea, right? That because free will is important, so God won't stop it. Again, there's a limit to that because really, so you're going to let people do everything. There's a limit because of natural suffering, which is from God. Yes.
So it goes back to, that still all hinges on the question of why did God need to create blood creatures to begin with?
Right, so that comes to justifying free will. Right? Right, which again is a much bigger philosophical question. Right? And that's why I said I'm just doing surveying it, right? Okay, I'm going to run a little bit faster through Katnut HaAdam. So theories of Katnut HaAdam arguably are a very good reading of Eov, right? Where Eov, especially at the end, we haven't gotten there, so I'm sorry, I'm cheating, right? Spoilers, right? Which is, right, how does Eov, which is like the classic book of suffering, how does it end? God turning to Eov out of the whirlwind and saying, Habata divchayam of chikerto mitalachta, right? Have you come to the springs of the sea or walked the recesses of the deep? Haniglola chashari mavet, vishari tzamavet tireh. Have you seen the gates of death been revealed to you, right? Or the gates of the shadow of death, right? Eizeh derech yishkot, right? He just goes, right? Yadata, skipping down, right? Yadata kiasti veledet rechay mecharabim. You know, for you were born, the number of your days is great, meaning, Misa veshchakim bechachma, right? He keeps telling him, right, who are you, basically, to challenge me, right? What? Yeah, all these wonderful things. Of course, that's what you jump on. Okay, fine, right? And Eov eventually says, you're right. And what does Eov say? How does he, what's his closing words? You're right. Right? Al kein em as v'nichamti al afer vefer. You're right. I'm sorry. I'm dust and ashes.
right? I'm nothing, right? Now, what does that, right? Now, what does that mean? Right now, so what does that mean? So I'm very gonna quickly say this, okay? But one part of theodicy, that the Rambam puts forth is the idea that, right, Rabbi Lam, the same article that Rabbi Avinah mentioned this morning, Rabbi Lam has this book about, the same book actually, about can Judaism believe in aliens?
Rabbi Lam Senior.
Yes, Senior. Aliens. He has a book, a famous article about aliens. It was like right when they thought they might have found extraterrestrials. And basically, he really nicely explores, is Judaism anthropocentric or not, right? Does it really believe that human beings, theologically, we definitely could. And, you know, at least in the case of Chazai Kreskes, he thought there were aliens or potentially aliens. He actually says that. He's like, yeah, well, if they're aliens, so what? Okay, they're aliens. So what do you want?
Is that the Noah's Ark?
So what Ray Lambs goes through is that for many people, the reason that it comes down to is, do you believe that the world, that universe was created just for man? Right? If people who believe it's only about man, they have trouble believing.
Is that what the Gemara says?
Okay, right, fine. But the Rambam doesn't believe this. And the Rambam in many, many places says no. Right? You have to realize that the proper theology is, especially because the Rambam believes that the sun and the moon and the stars also think about God and have some relationship with God, right? That no, right? You're just not, right? Now this leads to just one second. This just means at some level, now it doesn't fully answer the question, but what the Rambam points out is at some level, this begins to answer the question. Why does it begin to answer the question? It doesn't answer it, but what it does do is it reframes the question. Is that sometimes people blow suffering out of proportion because they think the world, the universe is created for man, and I'm obviously the most important person in the world, right? And therefore, I stubbed my toe, the world should never have been created, right? I bemoan the day that I was born, right? But at some level, right, at some level, at least part of the answer to theological problems might be, listen, the world doesn't exist for you, right? And in the grand scheme of things, it's not that we don't have to justify your suffering. It's that your suffering doesn't need as much justification as you think it does because you're blowing it out of proportion, right? So part of the answer might be, again, this idea of katnud ha'adam, right? And again, if you want me, I'll just read. This was actually the article that Rabbi Avinah quoted. Rabbi Lam just summarizes this, right? That there seem to be two castes of mind, two a priori orientations, diametrically opposed to each other. The older one, with its Pythagorean roots in Greek philosophy accepted by Plato and tacitly accepted in Jewish literature, what we might call the centripetal value structure, one which Sadia accepted and attempted to prove empirically in order to validate his anthropocentric notion. The other, which we might call the centrifugal value structure, propounded by Aristotle, and which... Okay, fine.
A lot of big words.
Fine. There's two views in Judaism. Rav Sadia Gaon adopts the view the world is created for man, and the Rambam says, no, it isn't.
Man, if only he just wrote that in his book.
Okay?
It's so much easier.
So there are, therefore, those who use this to not necessarily answer the whole question, but... at least mitigate the problem, okay? So I'm not going to go too much into depth with that, but that is a mitigating strategy.
Is there any, do they use our strategy outside of that?
Yeah, meaning this is a strategy, right? This is a strategy. I'm not going to spend too much time on it. No, because it can reframe it. It can say, listen, you have to justify it, but you have to justify it in perspective. Rather than saying this is the worst thing that has ever happened, right? You say it's bad, right? And it needs to be justified, but... Right, take it with a grain of salt.
What's it like recognizing everyone is an individual, but there's a lot of individuals, so don't.
Right, so being things are, okay. Right, so I'm not going to go through this too much, but it definitely mitigates the question. Okay, so I'm not going to spend too much time on it. Then there are the what's called skeptical theism or anti-theodicy. Now, this became very famous. I do want to at least make sure to get this. The Rav in many places, okay, has a kind of anti, right, theodicy. Now, it's an anti-theodicy. So, again, there are different types of anti-theodicy, and that's what, if you want, you can read David Chatz's article that I mentioned before. I put the book back on the shelf. Okay, I'm going to leave it here. I'll show you. It's the it's Judaism in an analytic world or something like that. It's over there in the small shelf over there. Right. It was one of those books that Ryan Ginsberg brought yesterday. So his article there is about theodicies, and he goes through different anti-theodicies. Right. So again, I read a few chapters. I'm in between a bunch of books. I read a few chapters. I'll probably finish it a little bit later, but. But I made sure to read that chapter before we hedge here, just to see what he said. It's a nice treatment. It's a very fair, very clear treatment of what anti-theodicy might look like, and what theodicy might look like, sort of broad strokes. So one type of anti-theodicy, again, there are different types. One is there is no explanation. Now, most Jews don't take that, right? One view of anti-theodicy, right, which is there is no reason for your suffering. Okay, that's a very extreme view, which I don't really believe. Another one is human beings can't know it. And as we saw, that is a machloket on Dav Zayin, right? Right, that's a machloket on Dav Zayin, right? The machloket about whether when Moshe said to God, let me know your ways, and one answer is he got it, and the other is he didn't get an answer, right? One of those clearly is, in a certain sense, anti-theodicy, in the sense that even Moshe couldn't understand it. That doesn't mean there isn't a reason. It just means that human beings can't understand it. That's a type of an anti-theodicy. Right? And then there's a pragmatic anti-theodicy, and that's going back to what we said in the Gemara in Daf Hey, which is, it could be that when the Gemara says, if something bad happens to you, yifashvesh b'masav, it's not saying a theodicy. It's not saying because everything you do and everything that bad that happens to you is because of what you do. It's that it's telling you a religious posture, right? That Judaism believes less in asking why, and more asking about, what do I do now? And the Rav really liked this. In many places, the Rav develops this. And he was one of the most, probably the most well-known of the modern articulators of this view. And I'll read you just a few quotes from the Rav. This is from Out of the Whirlwind. He says, yes, the topical halacha has evolved an ethic of suffering instead of a metaphysic of suffering. While the metaphysic is out to discover the ontological objective reason of suffering from within, the ethic posits meaning from within and without. It is concerned not so much, now the Rav is very careful, not so much, meaning he's not denying the value of theodicy, but he's saying, what is our primary responsibility? Okay? So it is concerned not so much with pathos as such, but with the pathetic mood of the person in distress. Now, pathetic here, he means having emotion. Pathos, ick. Right, yeah. With the assimilation of pain into the total eye awareness. With man's response to adversity and disaster.
You shouldn't super rationalize it because the guy's in pain. Just like, help.
No, but also yourself, right? That you shouldn't spend all the time philosophizing about why it happened. You should say, where do I go from now? He says, this is the difference. Let me just try to read the quote, and then we'll take it in a second. The metaphysic, this is the difference between a metaphysic and an ethic of evil. The metaphysic seeks to justify evil or deny its reality. The ethic of suffering seeks the transformation of an alien factum, which one encounters, into an actus, in which one engages, the succumbing to an overwhelming force into an experience impregnated with directedness and sense. In Halachic Man, he writes, Halachic man fights against life's evils and struggles relentlessly with the wicked kingdom. See what many religions have done to this world on account of their yearning to break through the bounds of concrete reality and escape to the sphere of eternity. Had they not desired to unite with infinity and to merge with transcendence, then they might have been able to do something to aid the widow and orphan. And Rabbi Sacks goes even farther, in a certain sense. Rabbi Sacks argues, remember I said before that one of the potential problems of theodicy is that it desensitizes you to the person in the moment, right? So it's not just that, right? It's not just that maybe if you spend too much on the why, you won't care about the what, but it's that by asking the why, you end up, instead of saying, I'm so sorry, Eov, you say, Eov, you are a shegetz, kaifer, bum, whatever, every, you know, bad, offensive thing I can say, right? So Rabbi Sacks actually goes in that direction, that asking why sometimes too much desensitizes you. Now, I will agree here that with Dr. Schatz, that this is not necessary, right? You could say that you're not supposed to ask why while you're sitting in front of the person suffering. That doesn't mean that asking why is illegitimate in general. But you don't need to go that far, but I'll just read you the quote from Roy Sachs. Moses hid his face, coming back to the Gemara in Daf Zayin, right? Because he was afraid to look at God. Why was he afraid? Right? Now, this is a crazy read of this Gemara, right? Remember, in the simple pshat of the Gemara in Daf Zayin is that Moshe wanted to understand God, and either God said yes or God said no. Roy Sachs, playing on the fact that Moshe hid his face because he was afraid to look at God, argues a third possibility, that maybe God gave him the opportunity, and then Moshe turned it down, right? So he says, why was he afraid? Because if he were to fully understand God, he would have no choice but to be reconciled to the slavery and oppression of the world, right? If he fully understood God, then, oh, this just makes sense. Why am I worried, right? Why do I care? From the vantage point of eternity, he would see that the bad is a necessary stage on the journey to the good. He would understand God, but he would cease to be Moses, the fighter against injustice who intervened whenever he saw wrong being done. He was afraid that seeing heaven would desensitize him to earth, that coming close to infinity would mean losing his humanity. Roy Sachs had a way with words. There is no denying he had a way with words. He was very eloquent. So there is this, and you find we show him as well, this type of anti-theodicy. Again, anti-theodicy might be a little bit strong for this, right? Because I don't think that all these thinkers would say it's totally illegitimate, right? You can, on the one hand, say I'm going to spend some time philosophizing and still say that's not my main response to suffering in the moment, right? You can have both, right? You can say that you shouldn't be consumed by, right? And that's how we read, if you remember, that's how we read Daf Hey, based on Rubenstein, right? Not that there isn't a theodicy, there isn't a justice out there. It's just that in the moment, that may not be what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to stick out your hand and help the guy, right? Help the guy out.
So asking why is more of the human reflex, the human response, whereas asking what to do is more of the growth.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Asking why humans need reason for stuff. Well, we look at the Holocaust and we're like, why did this happen? It's the people that rise up and say, okay, what are we?
Right. Meaning it's saying that that's exactly what the Rav is doing, is saying that the primary response should be, where do we go from here?
That doesn't mean that we need it.
Correct, right? Meaning there's extreme anti-theodicy ones, which are either we shouldn't understand it or we can never understand it, and therefore there's no point in asking that question. All we should do is ask what we should do from now. And then there's the ones who say, no, that's not our only response or not our primary response, right? And that's okay, right? You could say, I think there's a value to understanding God, to helping myself emotionally come to terms with pain, but my primary way of dealing with it, right? And again, probably not within Frum thought, but who is probably the most famous person? Not within Frum thought, but who is probably the most famous person, I would argue, post-Holocaust that provided not a theology of this sorts, but a philosophy of this sorts.
The meaning of life is to give life meaning. That guy.
Viktor Frankl, right? Viktor Frankl, right? Who's reading it now? I saw someone.
That's my point.
You have it. You want to? Anyways, right? So Viktor Frankl. Do you know who Viktor Frankl is? Okay.
Yeah, he was a Holocaust survivor.
So Viktor Frankl was a Holocaust survivor, but also before the war, He was a psychiatrist, right? He's a psychiatrist. And he came up with a founder of the school called Logotherapy, which says that the way you get through suffering the best is not by asking why, but is finding meaning in life. And he talked about his experiences in the Holocaust. So the people who made it through were not the people who felt bad for themselves, but were the people who said, my goal is to survive and build a family. My goal is to help that person, right, survive the war, right? So the people who ate less, right, because they gave half their bread to the person right next to them, but found meaning in life, right, he saw either survived more or didn't break psychologically, right? And therefore, in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, right, he argues that, at least practically,
right? Focusing not on why did this happen to me, but what meaning can I find in it is healthier. Again, that doesn't mean that you can't also ask why did it happen, but it means if you obsess about that rather than trying to make something of it, right? That's unhealthy, right? So you don't have to say that we reject entirely the idea that there is a theodicy, there is a justice, there's a theological question, right? That doesn't change the fact that you can very plausibly read the Gemara in Daf Hey as being, right, somewhat anti, right, theodicy by saying, if something bad happens to you, you should do tshuva. Not necessarily because that's what happened, right? That's why it happened, but because you should never lose the opportunity to find meaning in what happens to you, okay? So what we've seen so far, right, beyond what we've seen in previous weeks, are theodicies, again, there are theodicies that really just try to go through justice, right, and figure out how everything really works, right? And we've hinted at that at different points, right? And therefore, ones who will say things like, and you know what, I probably should spend like just 2 minutes on that. Probably the most extreme theology within Judaism that really, really, really focuses on theodicy in the classic sense, that theodicy is justified because everything God does is because of what you did. Who are probably the biggest proponents of this? Kabbalists who believe in Gilgulim, right? Right? Right, Gilgulim, right? The idea, what? Right? No, I'm not saying, right? But Gilgulim, right? The idea that, right? Because once you have Gilgul, once you have the idea that your soul, right? That you may be innocent, but your soul isn't, right? And that God is constantly trying to balance your soul over the span of many lifetimes. It's very easy to have a very classic idea of everything is really just reward and punishment if you only understood the big picture, right? So obviously there are whole groups of thinkers like that. Then there are those, again, we focus on God Lo Adam, who say that at some level, again, this is not the full answer, but theodicy, right? Suffering is justified by the fact that the point of the world is to grow.
What's and the name of the Christian guy?
John Hick. John Hick. John Hick. And the idea that the point of the world is to grow, and at some level, there are certain things you can only accomplish because of suffering, right? That changes who you are. Then there's Katnut Adam, which again, doesn't fully answer the question, because even if I'm nothing, I still shouldn't suffer for no reason. But it starts to answer the question because it forces you to reframe it, right? And then we talked about anti-theodicy positions who say that either you can't, right? Again, Dav Zion, you can't understand what God wants, or even if you can, you shouldn't dwell on it, because you should ask more, what can I do, rather than why did this happen to me? And again, that's a plausible read of Daf Hey, right? Of Daf Hey, of that's why you should do tshuva. Not necessarily because there's a one-to-one correspondence between what you did and why you're suffering, but because every time something bad happens, the proper response is to say, okay, how can I grow from this? Again, combine that with the fact, with what we talked about last week, the possibility that Chazal are really okay with the possibility, right, with the, at least the possibility that sometimes you suffer even though you don't deserve it, right, obviously that's going to have to work on some sort of either Katnut Adam, right, which is, listen, sometimes bad things just happen, or maybe some free will theodicy, right, or some sort of anti-theodicy, which is, look, yeah, bad things happen, but you're not supposed to ask why all the time, you're just asked to, you know, supposed to ask what. Again, I'm not denying the fact that there are certain thinkers that just think that, no, really, the theodicy is all justified by reward and punishment, right? And again, many Kabbalistic thinkers do go in that way with the Gilgulim. I'm looking at you because you said that, right? Rashi might be read that way, right? Which is, right, more, even more extreme. The notion that Yisur and Shalava might be that, you know, as long as it balances out in the end, if God pays you $5 every time he slaps you, so, you know, it's all fine. Right? If you think that's okay, that might answer it. This is only the beginning, right? And with this, I'll end, right? And maybe, you know, just a minute on this, but, you know, again, I'm not going to give this sikha because I don't know if I have anything to say in what's going on yet. I don't know if I formulated my thoughts. But it definitely is true that every time bad things happen in the world and, you know, we suddenly, the Cold War seems to have started again or lunch or whatever, you know, it is true that bad things happening is inherent to life, and we always ask, why did this happen and what can we do? That's just part of life. And realizing that, you know, that both hashkafically and halachically, we have so many possibilities, right? We have those people who think that you can't know the answers at all, right? Moshe didn't know the answer. And therefore, if you feel like you don't know what the answer is and you don't understand it,
There are people who say that's okay, right? Other people who say, no, everything's justified, and maybe you could figure it out. There are people who say that too, right? Right? Gilgulim, or, right, at least one possible read of Yifashish Maisev. If you're the person who says, listen, maybe there is a why, but I care more about the what, right? That's a plausible read of the Gemara and Daf Hey, and that's definitely the way the Rav focused on it. If you're the type of person who says, listen, I don't want to think about theology at all, right? I just want to focus on the person here and now. Forget everything else, right? Forget, right? That's all I care about. That's a plausible read of Hey, I'm a bet, right? So all these different types of approaches find their voice in the Gemara, find their voice in the interpretation, and they might work together, right? And it could be that at different points you look at different things. I think that it makes a lot of sense that this question animates religious people, because we do intuitively want to be close to God, and when we're suffering, it's hard, right? And we think that God is good, even if we don't focus on the omnis the way Christianity is, we still think God is good, and therefore these things bother us. And therefore it's legitimate to ask the questions. I'm not going to answer everything for you, right? I'm not going to give you every approach. But we saw how just in Brachot, this comes up at least three times, right? That we talked about in very serious ways. And for obvious reasons. So what I've tried to do is at least, you know, with using a lot from Aaron Siegel, from Elman, from Professor Elman, from David Schatz, from Jeffrey Rubenstein, right, who sort of do a lot of, bird's eye view, try to give you different types of responses, right, types of interpretation of these sources. Obviously, this is not complete. If you guys decide, and you can think about it for a little bit, that you dafka want to spend more time on this or another idea and really delve more, we can. We can decide to come back to it. We can decide, not doing that. We can decide to come back to, no, but remember, this is an Agadot year, right? This is not a philosophy year, right? As much as that philosophy, obviously they overlap, but we're trying to understand the Agadot in Brachot. Because it was at least three major Agadot in Brachot, we had to spend time on it. And I've tried to give you at least the tools to read these Gemaras, and obviously some tools for thinking about these issues in life, but there's so much to talk about. We haven't even talked about, we've only talked in human suffering, right? There's whole discussions in both Jewish and Christian thought struggling with animal suffering. C.S. Lewis has a fascinating chapter from Christian perspective on the problem in pain, of the problem of pain, if you ever want to read a very good Christian treatment of this issue. But in the Gaonim, there's actually discussion of pain for animals.
Yeah,
and how this fits in.
Josh.
I knew that was going to come up. Is that right? Okay, but so hopefully this at least these 3 weeks at least give you, I don't know if it's just an introduction, but at least a good head start into these issues. Again, if there's something you want to talk about, we in theory we can do that, but I'm going to stop because I'm already over time, and maybe at this point, right, Scholars figure out what he wants to say.